You're listening to a podcast from the Media Motel.
Coming up this week in episode 427, Barbie becomes gender inclusive. Would you go on a hunger strike over a TV show? And the horrors of immersive theatre. That's all coming up after Len and Steal My Sunshine.
I was lying on the grass of Sunday morning of last week, indulging in my self-defeat. My mind was thugged on least, the birds all twisted wrong beat. Uncomfortable on 3 feet deep. Now the fuzzy stare from not being there on a confusing morning week.
One hit wonders, but a lovely few minutes of swishy indie summer pop to have as your one hit, as featured in the Rolling Stone magazine Best Summer Songs of All Time, a top 10 hit in both the UK and America in 1999, Len and Steal My Sunshine.
I do like that. That was when I was still buying cassette singles as a teen, and I had that. And I weirdly, I think it might have been a bit like Mint Royale's Don't Falter featuring Lauren Laverne, which I also had on tape, in that they were very summery songs that, if I remember correctly, at least I bought them at a time when it really wasn't very summery, and one always sort of wondered if you wouldn't make a better job. I'm just trying to look to see when it came out as a single in the UK, because I think I remember listening to it in the autumn thinking, this isn't exactly, you know, sort of Miami Beach, you know, or Palm Springs kind of weather. But it was released in the summer. Maybe I bought it from a bargain bin, which again was plausible for teenaged me. But yeah, it came out, it was recorded in August 98, and it came out over here, and it became known as a sleeper hit, because radio stations began playing it in March 99, 4 months before they planned to release their album. And eventually, by the time it was released in July 1999, it sold really well because everybody knew it already.
Yes.
Which is interesting, isn't it?
Welcome to the podcast from the Parish Council. It's episode 427. I'm Terence Stackham, and let's welcome formally the Nancy Pelosi of British broadcasting. It's Juliet Harris.
I'm not entirely sure how to take that, but I appreciate it. Maybe it's a measure of my forcefulness. I don't know, which can only be a good thing, can't it? Although I would like at this point to nail my colours to the mast and you know, declare myself a Kamala Harris supporter, if only so that I can go to America and pose with her in Hastings, NY, as Harris is for America with Juliet Harris from Hastings, UK, in Hastings, NY. That is my dream. I doubt it will ever come true. But no, Nancy. Nancy Pelosi, that photograph that Trump shared of her standing up, shouting at him in that room. And as Jane Garvey put it on Twitter, thanks very much for the campaign poster, Mr. President. Yeah. That's really nice of you. The thing that really weirds me out about Trump and is like with what she called Alexandra Ocasio-Cortez.
AOC,
when him and his cronies posted that video of her dancing as a youth, which is actually quite flattering because they thought it would insult her. And then she did that brilliant viral piece on Twitter of her going home for the weekend from her office posing to War by Edwin Starr. That was such a wonderful way to react to it. And I love the fact that what Trump thinks is ammo is always, always used back against him in a really effective way. So good on Nancy Pelosi. He thought she was disrespectful for standing up, whereas what it showed was, why are we in a situation where someone has to stand up in a presidential meeting because he's being such a drongo?
And the aspect of it that really struck with me is there she was standing up, sort of pointing her finger at Trump. And as you looked around that table, she was the only woman in yet again a sea of middle-aged white faces.
Absolutely. And also I noticed I didn't see any evidence of anybody rushing to get up to defend Trump either. There didn't seem to be anyone that looked particularly angry around that table. Everyone just looked a bit like, oh, here we go again. Oh, man. It was given that most of the people around that table probably won't be there in 2 months anyway, because that seems to be Trump's apprentice.
Mr. Trump.
Well, I can but hope. But then I am aware that we have quite a large American listenership, which is really cool. And I suspect that that some of them may disagree with me. So I would like to see a Trumpless world, but it'd be interesting to see what happens.
It's time for our sensationally popular opening item.
Yes, indeed. Thank you to all two of you who tweeted.
It's episode 7 of Spot the Singer. Now, this is where I ask you, the listener, and you, the Juliet.
That's me, the Juliet.
The Juliet. To identify a singer without reference to Shazam or Soundhound. No cheating. To listen to a 30-second clip and just tell me who is the mystery singer. Now, here's the situation. It's 1990, and somebody says to one of the biggest names in music, look, all the kids want this new rap, hip-hop music, and you've got...
My toes have curled already. I don't know who it is, and I'm still already... I'm panicking already.
So who is this having a grim shot at a rap track back in 1990?
PhDs are strong as me with hypotheses. Give me a gal who teaches school, who's not afraid to break the rules. Women, doctors, and lawyers, too, can really make a man out of you.
So sorry to have imposed that 30 seconds.
Terence, you're gonna be the death of me, man. Jeez. I mean, there's always the added frisson of the variable quality of the music down the phone line anyway, so it doesn't always sound like they're playing in an abattoir somewhere regardless of who it is. But that person has confused rapping with shouting, haven't they? They've just gone. If they just shout, that would be. Oh man. So you say biggest stars in music?
Really, really big name.
Huge in music. I want to say Cliff Richard, but it sounds like an American voice.
Correct.
I am going to say. I'm going to say Pat Boone. I know he had an ill-advised foray into metal, but I wonder if he might have done something that strange as well.
This is going to make you weep. It's a clip from the song Smart Girls, written as part of a mercifully unreleased album. Say hello, in this case, to the misguided genius of a man that you have seen in live in performance in the rain?
Oh, it's not Brian Wilson.
It's Brian Wilson.
Oh, my goodness. Oh, man. That was the point at which they really should have just stopped him going out, really, shouldn't they? Oh, man. That is awful.
That strange period when Brian Wilson, for about 10 years, he was under the spell of that unconventional psychotherapist, Eugene Landy, who seemed to have some very curious financial only a retrograde, ultra-conservative would want to return to the days of strictly defined roles for male and female genders. And most people, I think, would support people being free to be who they want to be in life. And I think it's an interesting point, though, when we consider at what age people should be considering gender issues. Now, this week it's been announced that the toy company Mattel are launching gender-inclusive dolls. This is the company responsible for Barbie dolls. Come on, Barbie, let's go party. And
do you know, if they still had stars in their eyes, I would be sending you.
I'd be a shoo-in.
They get one of those bulb wigs for you to be that weird, that Renee, I think his name was, that weird shouty man from Aqua. Oh, man, I would pay money to watch that. Bring it back, guys. Jeez.
This new range from Mattel, it comes with switchable hairstyles and clothes to vary from what once might have been termed masculine or feminine. Now, I need help to understand this, Jules, because I'm all for educating children about all the possibilities they've got ahead of them in the world. But does a four-year-old playing with dolls need to make these decisions?
Well, this is what's so interesting about it. And you could argue, how old do children have to be before they start consciously making decisions? Not just making decisions about what they want to do, because kids can make decisions from a really young age about what they want to eat, for example. That seems to be a kind of a way, although that's the hardest thing, I think, about being a parent when it first starts off, trying to work out what your small person that can't actually say any words is trying to express to you. That's why I love that episode of The Simpsons where Homer's brother, long lost brother Herb, reappears having had his fortune lost by Homer the first time round, and it makes his fortune again by making a piece of kind of hardware that manages to translate babies' gabble into them saying what they would like to do and so what food they want or when the baby needs its nappy changing, that sort of thing. It's difficult to work out that line. And so as a parent, you're an interpreter for about the first 4 to 5 years, I think. So it's interesting to see at what point parents stop being interpreters. Because, of course, when you are an interpreter, when you're translating any sort of text, there are always decisions to be made which are coloured by your own judgment, aren't they? So to some extent, and I like the same with any kind of, I can't believe I'm going so Sue's corner on this, but any kind of textual analysis, you can always put your own spin on that, and your own opinions and your own kind of assumptions might mean that your translation of a text might be slightly different to my translation of a text, because it's all open to interpretation. So I suppose what I'm trying to say is that if you are a parent choosing a toy for a child, there is a possibility that you are choosing it for yourself and for reasons of wokeness and how it looks to other parents, as you might be choosing it to for what your child wants. So I think that's what you might be pondering on here, I suspect, in that, you know, I think they're a good thing. I think the idea, so looking at this article from The Independent about sort of unpacking this a bit, what they're basically saying is that they called them, Barbie manufacturer Mattel have launched a new line of gender inclusive dolls. So there seems to be a new range of dolls. So it's not like they've suddenly made Barbie into a kind of a Miley Cyrus kind of sex positive feminist, which I would buy, by the way. That would be amazing. And I enjoyed Miley Cyrus's kind of sex positive in control of herself set at Glastonbury very much indeed. But so it's a new line of toys and they call them gender inclusive, and they say they allow children to express themselves freely. And what I think makes them quite good is that the Creatable World toys come with a number of different clothing options, accessories and hairstyles, so that kids can style their doll with long or short dresses and dress them in a skirt, trousers or both. Perhaps not, because I was around for the skirt trousers thing in the late 90s and it was not good. But they've said that each pack contains one doll, two hairstyle options and, quote unquote, don't we all want this in our lives, endless styling possibilities. I mean, I feel like live that sort of life anyway. But it's interesting to see, and I suspect that some of our moral panicky friends in the Christian right and similar would be set, would want to take this line. When kids play with toys, and particularly certain types of toys like dolls and, you know, well, any types of toys really, I suppose, you could say particularly when kids play with toys at a young age, to what extent are they playing with toys because that's what they like, or to what extent are toys helping them to order their, I say, to order their thoughts and to work out what they like and to help develop their personality. So actually, the plus side to that, from my point of view, is isn't it great that kids have got the opportunity to express themselves however they want? And actually, you might, but by having so many different styling options to a doll and so many different ways in which you can express personality through a doll, isn't it really cool? You might end up with kids finding their personality and being comfortable in themselves much sooner in their life because they've got an opportunity to do that, perhaps in the case of young kids, before they've got much of the language to be able to express that. Of course, the downside to that is, you know, is it possible that children are too young to deal with these things, and do children end up being forced into these kind of decisions about gender and you know, and how to express themselves too early on? My view is probably more towards the former than the latter, maybe because I am a liberal, open-minded kind of, that's kind of how I live. I don't know, but I think I get that sometimes this kind of constant wokeness, and my friend calls it competitive parenting, and I really like that as a phrase. She shared a picture of a little girl whose Halloween costume was one went as Predator and one went as Alien, and it was really cool. And she said, I usually hate this sort of competitive parenting where parents are like, look at me through the medium of their child, but actually I genuinely really like this. And so I get there is a danger that, you know, if you're buying woke Barbie for your child, it's the parent that's saying, look at us, aren't we super liberal and groovy and cool? But equally, if these toys genuinely help children to express themselves and are fun and are an easier way for them to sort of subconsciously deal with these things, I think that's a good thing on balance, although I do hear the concerns that would be the other side of that argument.
I must confess, I haven't quite thought of it that way, and I think that's a very sound argument, but I can't help but consider that it could be left as a simple situation. If a four-year-old boy wants to dress up Barbie and play around with jewellery, let him. And if a four-year-old girl wants to play with a Superman doll, let her. And then allow them to make bigger decisions later in life. I'm not sure pushing the need to make gender choices at kindergarten is safe. I
don't disagree, but what I'm saying is that equally, I guess the counter argument to that is, yes, but having said that, it might turn out to be that somewhere along the line, continually pushing children into boundaries. So it's difficult. You can be someone that agrees with that, but equally says, but on the other hand, isn't it frustrating how boys and girls are gender stereotyped from such a ridiculously young age? And that if you want to buy something for a little girl, I wanted to buy something for my friend's kids. I think she was 5 the other day, and so I wanted to go and get something that I thought she might like. And I'd asked them the sort of questions about what I thought she might be interested. And I didn't put anything up online, but I nearly did, because it was almost, there's a campaign, I think, called something like Pink Stinks, which people get really cross about everything for a girl being pink and everything being boy, and to the point where that was it. I went to somewhere like the Early Learning Centre, something similar, somewhere similar to that. It was where the Early Learning Centre was in Hastings, but I don't know if it still was the Early Learning Centre, but it said sold toys, so I went in and I noticed that I wanted to buy her a doctor dressing up costume. And you could only buy a boy doctor dressing up costume. Oh. The girl doctor costume was a nurse's uniform.
Oh man!
And equally, a friend of mine had the different dilemma recently, in that his partner is a male nurse, and their son wanted a male nurse outfit like his dad, and they couldn't find one. And I could only find little girl nurse uniforms. So I think stuff like that is ridiculous. So if it's a kind of a kickback against that, then I think that's only a good thing. So actually, I think that, yes, I agree that there is a danger around trying to push people in that decision. But equally, aren't kids being pushed into gender stereotypes already by this kind of pink, blue sort of segregation. That seems to be getting worse rather than better. So actually, I think that if it's an overhaul of attitudes towards how gender with kids generally, actually people might sort of panic about the idea of, you know, or what if we're trying to persuade kids they're the wrong gender very early on when they're not. But equally, I think it's really damaging to, I mean, the word sort of toxic masculinity and that kind of stuff almost seems kind of such a cliche, you know, it's almost wokeness levels of cliches now. But equally, I think it can be equally damaging to tell boys from a very young age that, you know, only boys can be doctors, only girls can be nurses. I think that's really damaging to kids. So actually, I think I on balance work on this on the basis that I think that this blue, pink girl, boy kind of gender stereotyping toy thing in the other direction is also incredibly dangerous and damaging long term.
Yeah. Now, coming next, how much do you love TV? Enough to go on hunger strike if a network cancels your favourite show?
What do you want more, TV or food? That is. I mean, ideally, I want both, so this is difficult for me.
That would be a tough call, wouldn't it? That's next, right after the Andrew Oldham Orchestra.
Thank you.
I know that Terence is often very, occasionally gets a bit upset when I used to pick sixties instrumentals on a fairly regular basis. So they were twangy, and I actually had a whole CD for my car at one point that I very nearly sent Terence as a surprise Christmas present, but I did stop myself at the last minute. So that sounded dangerously like it was going to be one of those instrumentals until they suddenly start. So I love those kind of tracks where all of a sudden, just when you think it's an instrumental, half the third go, oh, quit, we better do some vocals on this. So some local vocals even. So I love Wikipedia's straight fatness again. Andrew Luger Oldham, he was manager and producer of the Rolling Stones from 1963 to 1967 and was noted for his flamboyant style. That's such a calm way of saying they're potentially unsayable, isn't it, really? And I like this anyway. I'm using this as part of my continued feature, my accidental featurette to go with the guest the singer, which is the guest the spot the sample. So this is not
a tough one, is it?
No, I don't feel it is at all. And you might be surprised that the string section that you heard there was on that record rather than the record that you think you know it from. So that was an orchestral version of The Last Time by the Rolling Stones, by the Andrew Oldham Orchestra, which appears to be something fairly put together in my view, which comes from the Rolling Stones songbook album.
19 years old when he started managing the Rolling Stones. Intriguing figure, Andrew Luger Oldham. Sorry,
not to be confused with Andrew Lloyd Webber, which seems to be the most natural way to tumble out of your mouth, isn't it?
Yeah, still with us, of course. And you know, although he's a strange character, and as I think you quoted there, you know, what was that phrase? I can't remember what you said about him.
Noted for his flamboyant style,
but. Later set up, of course, the amazing Immediate Records.
Absolutely. You know, there's some incredible. Although I believe, I'm just checking because I've got some Immediate Records stuff that is actually, you say it's got pink labels, but some of the early stuff, I believe, was in black and white labels and black and white sleeves, because I've got Out of Time. By Chris Farlow, yeah, and that's on a sort of a black and white. I think it's on a black and white sleeve and a black and white label, if I remember correctly. This is a kind of deeply consequential conversations that I have.
Of course, I'm old enough to, you know, have bought stuff at the time, and I remember buying Small Faces and Humble Pie singles on the Immediate label, which were and indeed still are, you know, in my collection. The pink. And black, but who knows?
I think there's a lot. They're sort of. I got it from my dad, so who knows? But they also have PP. They have PP Arnold on their label, who is very much a kind of a Hardy mod perennial. I first came across PP Arnold because she duetted with Ocean Colour Scene on one of the late 90s singles. I remember thinking she was really good, and she is apparently touring at the moment. So I'm quite tempted to go and see her. I must admit.
Did the stunning vocal on the Small Faces Tin Soldier.
Yeah, absolutely. She's one of those people. That gets sort of wheeled out every so often, and you just think, goodness me. And also, interestingly, she's also, did you know, a backing vocalist on Brighter Later by Nick Drake.
On Poor Boy,
the chorus backing vocals are her and Doris Troy, of all people.
Doris Troy, yeah. Doris Troy, again, a session singer, almost anything that needed a soulful voice in the late 60s, Doris Troy.
It just goes to show that people think of sessioners, they kind of sort of look down on them, don't they, really? Whereas there was a lovely documentary on BBC Four recently about, you know, the Wrecking Crew, and I think we've talked about them before on the podcast, and how actually there are some session singers and session musicians that will really go down in history, I think.
Yeah, well, we had a sort of similar with people over here, but they weren't as much of a team as the Wrecking Crew, because all on those, so many of those mid-60s recordings, you had Big Jim Sullivan, Doris Troy, PP Arnold, John Paul Jones, later in Led Zeppelin, Big Jim Sullivan, Jimmy Page, of course, on many of them, Rod Stewart on some. So
and Chas Hodges, as discussed last week. Yep.
Indeed. Now, The Wire, The Sopranos, Curb Your Enthusiasm, more recently Succession. These are TV shows that I've enjoyed greatly in the last decade or so. And it's a sad feeling when they finally come to the end of their run. But we get over these things and get on with our lives. except some people don't. Throughout history, some people take their affection for shows or the people who appear in them too far. And as an example, only this week in the UK, a man has been found guilty of stalking the pop star Harry Styles to a rather frightening degree.
I know. I was terribly sorry to hear that. That was really difficult.
In so many spheres of life now, you get these super fans who are prepared, kind of people who are prepared to queue all night outside an Apple store to be amongst the first to buy a new version of the iPhone. Most footballers recognize regular fans who stand outside the training ground every day in all weathers, hoping to get a glimpse of their favorite players. And even the seemingly innocuous Strictly Come Dancing show here in the UK has hired additional security and banned fans from taking photos in and around Elstree Studios after overzealous fans caught celebrities in embraces that that then affected their private lives. Now, Jules, this week, you're The Guardian has revealed some of the extremes fans of TV shows will go to, including one bloke who went on hunger strike outside the offices of Netflix in Los Angeles just because they cancelled a sci-fi show.
Well, I mean, and it's interesting. Isn't it funny how I almost knew before you said it that the words that you were going to tumble out of your mouth as a genre was sci-fi after that, after how that man. That sounds awful, and I'll probably get people outside my house now complaining about the fact that I've said about sci-fi. But it's really interesting how, and I'm always a great defender of TV as a medium, as an art form. And you could compare some of the TV fans' kind of out there obsessive behaviour with, for example, the girls that wet themselves and threw jelly babies at the Beatles, and the people that wait outside stage doors and things like that. It seems like it's fandom behaviour attaching to TV rather than something that's linked to TV itself. It does seem to be rather extreme behaviour, but I think it's worth drawing a distinction between the acts of individual people and the acts of a kind of a coordinated campaign of a fan base. And this Guardian article talks about how there are different, how in the age of social media particularly, it's become much easier to coordinate kind of fan style sort of movements in a way. And they often say when you write, and this sounds like a bit of an odd comparison, but bear with me, they often say that if you want to really get in touch with your MP about something, the way to do it is not to use one of those standard form 38 degrees emails or things like that. And it's not even to send an individualized email. If you really want your MP's attention and you cannot be bothered or aren't able to sit in their surgery, you send a handwritten letter. And they always get read first. They always get past the MP. That's almost a guarantee that you would at least get your correspondence read. And so these fans have kind of taken the same. And I know that, by the way, from having spoken to MP caseworkers. So I do know how that works from different parties as well. Which is interesting. But these fans do things like sending things in the post, and that works in the same way. It's easier for a TV station to ignore emails and delete them rather than post-apocalyptic show Jericho was cancelled by CBS after one season in 2006, prompting its fans to send 20 tons of nuts to the network's offices in protest. Inspired by a line from the final episode, which was nuts, the outpouring of nut-based feeling got the show one more season before it was axed again. Actually, it's quite an interesting way, and you could make parallels with Six Music here. Six Music was threatened with closure a few years ago, along with BBC Asian Network, and there was such an outcry about it that in the end the decision was reversed. And actually what it revealed was not that nobody listened to Six Music, it was that Six Music was not being publicized and marketed clearly enough, because actually its viewing figures, I think by the end of the whole thing they had nearly doubled its listening figures, simply because people didn't know it was there and people didn't know what it was about. Right. And now of course the BBC push Six Music continually, and they see it as a really important part of their brand, and it has become a gateway between Radio 1 and Radio 2. They've made a whole kind of station, and so in a way you could argue that they have nailed the 30s and 40s market, even, you know, even more so than they would have done previously. They've got a real, rather than expecting people to listen to Radio 1 until the age of 34 and then immediately instantly want to listen to Radio 2, they've realized what that was. But it took a massive campaign for them to try and think that through, and so it's interesting here that you've got, and that food stuff seems to be a popular thing. Sticking with food stuff, a sci-fi series, Roswell, which I remember watching and think it was quite good, was kept on air for 4 seasons of plummeting ratings after fans bombarded its channel with bottles of Tabasco as part of the Roswell is Hot petition. Oh, it is Lord. Estimated that over 3,000 bottles of hot sauce were sent in total until the campaign ran out of heat and the show was cancelled for good in 2002. It's really interesting what an impact those can have. Again, there was a high school football drama, which I've never watched, but I have friends that were really into it, that was called Friday Night Lights, that was on NBC in America. In 2007, so it's about sort of a high school football team, and it looked like it was going to be axed, and fans started sending streams of light bulbs to their offices, to NBC's offices, as well as eye drops, because it was a reference to the Dillon Panthers, who were the team's motto, which was clear eyes, full of heart, can't lose. They saved the show for 3 more seasons. So wow. It's really interesting that TV networks, in the same way as MPs, caseworkers, and in the same way as the BBC, if you can show that there are enough people that feel strongly about something that makes you think, well, in which case this might have a wider indication. If there are 30,000 people that care enough to go out of their way to send nuts to a TV producer's office, which is, you know, clearly not entirely, I mean, I have to be honest and say it's not entirely normal behaviour, is it, really? It's not ordinary behaviour. I mean, I've done some weird things in my time, and I've never mailed food to anywhere. I did have the Children's Trust send me a curly whirly via Twitter once because I won their competition, but I would find that a really odd thing to do. But clearly, if you do something as out there like that, you clearly feel passionately about something, and it's quite inventive, I suppose, the Roswell is Hot campaign. So it sounds really strange, but I can see why it works. Because usually stuff gets axed because the ratings are falling, by and large, unless it's a very rare situation like Fawlty Towers, or perhaps nowadays Fleabag actually is perhaps another indication, or Detectorists, that as these shows become more successful, people then want to go out on a high, and so that seems to be one way of dealing with it. But it looks like otherwise, unless shows are pulled by their networks rather than the creatives in charge of them, because they are not doing business. They're not getting the ratings in, particularly on the commercial networks in the US. It's a slightly different comparison for the BBC over here. That was about how best to allot its funding. But it's interesting that it must be a sign to executives that if people care this much, then maybe because we'll save it, they'll make more of an effort to watch it and tell their friends, and also there'll be publicity as a result. And again, like the Six Music thing, you know, is there such a thing as bad publicity? It's maybe people would think, even not even consciously but subconsciously, oh, you know, if these people have sent, maybe they'll notice it's on. So you see a news story about people sending, you know, hot sauce to the producers of Roswell, you think, God, that's ridiculous. But then when you notice that Roswell is on, you notice it's on in a way that perhaps you might not have done previously. So I know it sounds, well, nuts to use the phrase, but it kind of makes sense. It's a weird phenomenon, but maybe it's just a way of the hunger strike bloke is a slightly different issue, but maybe it's just a way of really good campaigning.
In most recent years, social media, of course, the contact on social media helps people mobilize and egg each other on, whereas previously fanaticism or superfans were left to really just paper their bedroom walls with posters and just sort of dream wistfully. But a lot of this, I think, is born of the misplaced belief that some people unfortunately come to believe that because they see a person on TV or on the internet, they begin to feel they know them. And you often see this particularly on Twitter, where people try to engage in bants or personal chat with a celebrity in a rather cringe-worthy way in the mistaken belief that they're somehow intimate with that personality. And then when the reality, of course, is starkly different. And this is how stalking, and I just think I'm tying this in because I think it's this fanaticism
it's a good link.
You know, as in that Harry Styles case, it can begin that way, and it's a worrying trend. So it's kind of love your TV shows, but keep life in perspective.
Yeah, no, I don't disagree. I think that makes sense, which is why I tried to make a difference between organized fan campaigns and people going on hunger strike, because I think there is a difference here. I think it's a sliding scale, like you say.
Coming up next, the sheer horror of immersive theatre.
Well, in your view.
Indeed, that's right after this splendid track from Young Gun, Silver Fox.
1, 2, 3, 4.
Well, with the Silver Seas rather quiet these days, it falls to this group to be allocated the Terence Stackham Best Group in the World Award. If you like Steely Dan, Hall & Oates, Donny Hathaway, Stevie, give this band a wider listen. This was the lead track from their second album, their 2018 album, AM Waves, Young Gun, Silver Fox and Midnight in Richmond.
Well, I have to say, as a previous recipient of the Terence Stackham Best Band in the World, as part of my Go Bird Seer duties, I'm glad to pass the flame on to something so good.
When I go to Stamford Bridge to see Chelsea, there's a dismal chant that a few hundred Egypts start up at most games. Stand up if you hate Tottenham. And, well, I don't hate Tottenham, and even if I did, I can't be bothered standing up in the middle of a football match.
I was going to say, for goodness sake, I've just opened my incredibly overpriced hot dog. What do you expect me to do? Yeah.
It's a grotesque attempt at getting fellow supporters immersive in the moment. And in another area of life, the worst thing to hear at a gig is the singer saying, OK, here's one you can all join in on. And I think, no, I've come to see you perform. Don't include me in the entertainment. Paul McCartney does this in his live shows with Hey Jude. And although I love him dearly, I wish he wouldn't bring in audience participation. I want to hear Paul McCartney sing Hey Jude, not a bunch of over-enthusiastic, shouty people all around me at the O2. Earlier this year, someone very dear to me took us to the theatre as a Christmas present. And lovely, until in the car on the way to the theatre, I was told it was an immersive production. I nearly did a U-turn on the M4 and turned the car around there and then. Immersive, Jules, it's a word to strike terror into the veins of theatre-goers. And I think it seems some performers too.
Well, it's interesting that you should say this, because you speak to a woman, which is me, who is possibly going to go to an immersive theatre thing.
Oh,
next
you poor,
month.
Poor woman.
No, I'm really looking forward to it. So let me tell you. Yeah. So this immersive theatre, when you say it can be difficult for the performers, you are referring to a piece in the stage, which immersive production variant 31 evicts audience members for physically abusing staff. So obviously, to use my much worn phrase, that is not ideal. There was physical aggression as part of this. And immersive theatre has become quite a sort of a popular, a trendy thing.
Didn't happen to John Gielgud.
Well, quite exactly. But anyway, Secret Cinema has done quite a few sort of staging of films. I think we talked about this before, where you go to watch a screening of the film, but the film is being acted out around you, for example. And I know some of you have been really, really impressed by it. So there's another piece in the stage that I would like to contrast with this. So I get that it is annoying if you are going to see something that it is deeply vexing if you then have to take part in it. It sometimes shows an insecurity on behalf of the performer. I remember watching, I think, Robbie Williams at Live 8, so the sequel to Live Aid, the concert that took place in 2005, and I was watching it with my dad, and we watched Pink Floyd and we watched Robbie Williams, and my dad said to me afterwards, that was such an insecure performance by Robbie Williams. And I went, what do you mean? And my dad said, every other moment he kept saying, are you with me?
Constantly.
And my dad said that isn't someone that's trying to kind of, you know, get everyone to enjoy the moment with him. That is someone that is panicking and is desperately insecure. I don't know if that's true or not, but I thought it was an interesting analysis. My parents always do this. My mum once told me when she saw me seeing you might remember late 90s, early noughties pop rapper Sisqo, who was famous for The Thong Song, which is an execrable kind of poppy rap record. He was being interviewed about that and Unleash the Dragon, his other equally tedious song with connotations, on T4. And he was sort of bragging and boasting about how great he was. And my mum just looked at him and went, that man has got such an inferiority complex. So there is a side to that. But having said that, I think that immersive theatre, I think, can be a different thing to singing along at a pop concert, particularly if done on a small scale. And so I point you to another article in the stage. Full and frank disclosure here, it is written by a friend of mine about a venue at which I have visited. So it's written by my friend Emma Burnell. So she took up the offer of a sort of a theatre company to host a immersive theatre show in her flat. So I've stayed in this flat, and she hosted a preview of Any One Thing's latest production, Souvenir.
I'm already hyperventilating thinking about it.
So she literally, and I don't know if I'm going to be able to do to sort of keep you on board after this, but she sold, I think it was 7 tickets were sold to strangers. She didn't know who they were, and they attended her home. But she decided that she was okay with it. And so she said, and so it's a really interesting piece, actually. It's worth reading. So she says, at first, the effect was slightly unnerving. At the start of the drama, the audience is attending a surprise 30th birthday party, milling around, waiting for the guest of honour. It was during this time I felt least engaged because I was self-conscious of not letting on that it was my flat. So she was sort of taken away and then brought back, and the members of the audience didn't know it was her flat. So she said she was talking to the other... She said, talking to the other 7 audience members, I was often asked if I'd come a long way, to which my only response was, well, not really. Whilst they had put away any personal photos to ensure it didn't look like my flat, they still left out my posters and knickknacks. The audience was respectful of the space, but obviously curious. Watching them look around was a bit like that excruciating part of Come Dine With Me. Thankfully, no one was rummaging around in my drawers. As the drama kicked in and became more about the actors and their unfolding storyline, this uneasy feeling went away until I found myself welling up while standing next to the hob, watching 3 people I believed in completely as their hearts broke. This was no longer my place. It belonged to them and their story. So actually, it sounds like a really interesting thing. She says it takes a certain type of person to contemplate opening up their home to be a theatre venue. She said they left the place far more spotless than it had been before, which in a way is perhaps a good way of getting a cleaner. But I'm interested in this idea of immersive theatre. It's actually Emma that's persuaded me and some friends of ours to book this immersive theatre performance. We're going to something, hopefully next month, once we can sort a date out, called Crisis What Crisis. So it's put on by Design My Night with Collab Factory. The thing is, the country is in chaos. Can you do a better job than the politicians? The year is 1979. Jim Callaghan's Labour government has a working majority of 0. Parliament is in deadlock. The country is crippled by strikes. Relations between British government and trade unions are at an all-time low. The IMF has agreed a financial bailout for Britain, but on the condition that punitive wage freezes are implemented across the public sector. The people are angry. The IRA is a source of constant fear, and the National Front is on the march. Britain's new friends on the continent, the European Economic Community, look on nervously. So do the British armed forces, and the rumour has it the Americans. This is a world familiar to those who were there, but it seems to have got even worse. You were right there in the thick of it. Margaret Thatcher's Conservatives have tabled a vote of no confidence against the government. If even one Labour MP does not vote in support of the Prime Minister, the government will fall. You and your fellow parliamentary advisers have been gathered in a neglected office building, away from the prying eyes of the press, to find a way of averting disaster. The clock is ticking, and you can choose to, and who you choose to work with can make all the difference. Can you end the deadlock and get the country back to work, or will you hand the opposition the keys to number 10? And basically, there are some actors in this, so you come across actors that come in, so you know, different advisors are played by actors and things, but basically it's done in incredibly small showings, and you're in the play, so you basically have to make these decisions. So it's like a massive role-playing game, but with actors involved. And I have to say, I'm really looking forward to it. I really can't wait to do this. I think it's going to be really good fun. So actually, usually I would say kind of, you know, sympathetic and understanding things to your hatred of immersive theatre. What I'm saying is, yes, I'm with you. It's really annoying when I've paid to see a gig, in the same way that I am annoyed when Jeremy Corbyn asked me to submit a question for him to ask at Prime Minister's questions. I feel like saying, you're the one that's on the 6-figure salary. Can you do that for me, please? But I don't need to do this for you. It's fine. I'm happy for you to do it as leader. It's okay. Go ahead. So I agree with you that it's annoying when you're asked to contribute to things that you feel should be provided to you, but actually I'm really looking forward to this immersive theatre thing, because you're paying for the experience of taking part. So actually, in terms of immersive theatre, it's a bit different to being told to sing along at a pop concert, because you're going to do that. That is the point. You are signing up to immersive theatre to be a part of it, really. So I'm looking forward to it.
See, being a misanthrope, I keep thinking this is all just going to get worse, isn't it? Because with the seemingly unstoppable rise of artificial intelligence and virtual reality, we're all going to be wandering around dazed and confused about what's real and what's just in our headsets or the microchip fitted into our brains at birth or whatever futuristic hell awaits us.
Well, on the plus side, though, I will let you know how I get on with persuading the 1979 Labour Party to vote in favour of their Prime Minister. I'll report back.
Just from a personal level, you mentioned Robbie Williams, as he once exclaimed, "Let me entertain you." Yes, you up there on the stage, you do the entertaining. I don't need to be immersed in it, thank you very much. But that's my personal view.
It goes right back to Robbie Williams, doesn't it? Everything, always. It would seem, having featured as part of... Was he still in Take That when they did that terrible cover of Smells Like Teen Spirit, or had he fled by that point?
I think he'd moved on to a different life at that stage, yes. He wasn't in the video, certainly. Now, thanks very much, as ever, to you, the listener, for listening.
Yes, always indebted at all times. Thank you.
And thanks to Hilly and Rona as well. Now, Jules, I actually never tire of watching the video of our closing track.
Yes, so true. Who couldn't love a northern man from Wigan in a leather jacket walking down a glamorous street, literally shoulder barging out of the way? It's how I live my life, Terence. I'm really into this. So this is our Spot the Sampler this week, which, as you put it, isn't terribly hard. The real question that comes out of this is, I don't know how they ever thought they were going to get away with this, frankly. If you're going to rip off anyone, why would you rip off the former highly litigious manager of the Rolling Stones, who also has a link to Alan Klein, who, let's face it, is the man that allegedly broke up the Beatles? This is magnificent. And I think that I just wish they had cleared the sample. That's all they needed to do. Why not just clear the sample? This was 97, so there were people, sampling was starting to become known in dance music. Maybe that's the key. I can't imagine they weren't aware. It seems a bit odd that they wouldn't be aware that they would need to do this, and they weren't advised that they need to do this. It'd be interesting to see if there's any more litigation as a result of that against their managers and lawyers that didn't advise them to do that. But it's so magnificent, this, I think, and I think that it's actually a good example of a brilliant use of a sample to completely elevate that extract and to make it sound absolutely marvelous.
I think it's one of the best ones ever.
I think so, and it's one of my favorite ever records, I think, and in a way that, whilst I thought that Andrew Lou Goldham Orchestra's The Last Time was perfectly pleasant, is just not the same. It really isn't. And it's such a shame that the events took the turn that they did, because really it's so enhancing, isn't it? It's just a wonderful use of someone's art, but eventually it came down to litigation about money, because it always does. But anyway, this is just glorious, and it hasn't aged a second as well. Although it's so evocative of a particular time in Britain in the 90s, I still think it sounds wonderful. This is The Verve, led by Richard Ashcroft, and this is Bittersweet Symphony.
change, I can change, I can change. But I'm here in my mold, I am here in my mold. And I'm a million different people from one day to the next. I can change my mold, no, 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 no. Have you ever been? I can change, you know, I can change. Cause it's a
listening to a parish council production.